Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Monday. It is April. Things are looking up. We had 4 million vaccinations on Saturday. That seems pretty good. We, of course, had the Final Four. Tonight we have the championship game. And we're joined by Jesus Uncancelled. Oh, no, that's your name that you put on the screen. That's Tim Miller. So people ought to know behind the scenes, we do this on a program called Zencaster, so that when the participants of the podcast sign in, they can put in any name they want. And so I have Boycott Tim Miller, which we'll explain in a minute. And then you signed up as Jesus Uncancelled.
Yeah, that was Lauren Boebert's tweet on Easter, you know, which is obviously just demonstrated the seriousness with which she takes her faith. And you know,
Jesus,
I was a Christmas baby, and I've got kind of a Jesus-esque hairdo right now, so I felt like that was a good bio for me.
So I mentioned right before we started, I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking that the word canceled and woke, we're just going to be sick of it by June. It's going to be one of those pandemic things where we just hit the wall. We're just done with it. It's when you had that sense when you saw a congresswoman from Colorado on Easter Sunday tweeting Jesus Uncancelled, that maybe that had run its string. You know, that it's run its course.
You think that the analogy's lost its potency now that you're comparing the resurrection to an uncanceling potentially? I can't find it. I was scrolling. So there was somebody who, you think you're tired of it, Charlie. Both of these terms, you know, kind of I don't know, invented is wrong, but were repopularized on Black Twitter, right? And it was like, you know, kind of Black folks talking amongst themselves. And so, you know, you've got to understand the frustration there to now watch Lauren Boebert, you know, kind of steal the slang and use it as a way to
and make it really, really dumb. Yeah, no.
Yeah. I mean, imagine Scott. It was Eugene Scott of the Post that tweeted that. It was really good.
Well, this is the fate of, you know, somebody that comes up with something really, really clever, something witty, and then it's appropriated by Beavis and Butthead, and they make it to the stupidest thing. Hey, I have a post Easter present for you, though.
Great.
I was going to say in the Lauren Boebert tradition, but not. Her tweet was, I would say, inappropriate, but you know, it's hard to match the Easter message to the world from the former guy. You saw that, right?
I actually missed it. So this is fresh for me.
Happy Easter to all, in caps.
That's nice.
Including the radical left crazies all in caps, who rigged our presidential election and want to destroy our country, exclamation point. Okay, here's the test. Did I make that up or is that real? Okay, Tim Miller.
Well, it's real because it's back to, you know, the kind of tweets that he was sending before he even ran. You know, remember when it was like back in the Trump's heyday of where when he got popular into Twitter, he would do things like happy 9/11 anniversary to even, especially to the haters and losers. I'm making that one up. Like it was,
no, that was pretty close.
He would literally do stuff like that. So, you know, everything's old is new again.
Yeah. Remember when we used to say the presidency changes a man? Well, apparently not at all. Okay. So here's my post Easter present. The former Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner. By the way, I would really love to get him on this podcast. I just want to say this. I just want to put it out there. I would love to have John Boehner, but I want to tape it after 8 o'clock at night. You know what I'm saying here? So
I think that he could probably be after 1 in the afternoon, but I see what
whatever.
You're saying.
So he did an audio book of his new book, which is coming out next week. And apparently, I mean, the word on the street is maybe it's shtick, maybe it's real, that it was Cabernet enhanced, shall we say. And so that there would be readings that he would do, and then he would kind of just riff, Cabernet riff, or Merlot riff, or whatever. Here's actually, and I think it was it Jonathan Swana got his hands on one of the tapes or something?
I think so.
Okay, so I want to give credit where credit is due. This is the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, talking about fundamental conservative values and what makes America special, but stick with it.
Freedom means you can be a genius and invent new products that make you millions of dollars and helps millions of people. It means you're free to work your way to becoming the first in your family to go to college. It means you're free to reach as high as you want, no matter where you came from, even if you're a little kid sweeping a bar out in Southwest Ohio. Take it from me. You'll never know where you'll end up. That's freedom. I'll raise a glass to that any day. P.S. Ted Cruz, go fuck yourself.
How does this guy not have a podcast? I mean, at this point, John Boehner speaks for all of America there.
Yeah, well, so Charlie, I hope this doesn't hurt your ability to get John Boehner on the podcast. So if you're listening, no. Speaker, just go ahead and press the fast forward button a couple 30 seconds. This is maybe a theme of today's podcast. You can hold two thoughts in your head at the same time. One thought being, that's a really funny line. And the other thought being, kind of F you, John Boehner, from me. John Boehner is writing this whole book, and his PR strategy seems to be to attract liberals to read it, by leaking these little tidbits, attacking Ted Cruz and Roger Ailes and all this, which he's right about, by the way. And it seems to be working, his book's selling, but John Boehner voted for Trump both times. I mean, definitely once in 2016, he voted for Trump. In 2020, he didn't say anything. And so I'm left a little bit feeling empty by the fact that he wants to come out and to be a strong truth teller right now with his book and wants everybody to buy his memoir, while during the 2020 election, he like made a wry joke about how he'd rather, rip his toenails off or something than get involved in picking a side. And I think what was the most obvious choice facing the country in memory. And so that, I don't know that I'm going to be purchasing it. I can chuckle at that clip without saying that I'm a little bit on John Boehner.
Yeah. I'm going to purchase the book because I'm probably gonna get the audio book too. I have a really long drive. Is it next week is coming out? I have a long drive this week. I might get it on audiobook to listen to it. Okay, so I have something else. You and I have not talked about Matt Gaetz, and this story is just gets furrier and furrier and hairier and hairier. Mehdi Hasan has a show on Peacock, but also on MSNBC. You're familiar with Mehdi Hasan's stuff? I am a big fan. Now, he is way to the left of me. I understand that we are not ideologically aligned, but he is one of the real bright rising stars. I mean, this guy is gifted. He strikes me as, have you ever noticed the difference between BBC interviewers and American television interviewers? The BBC guys are way more aggressive.
Yeah,
and they're just, I'm not trying to diss anybody, but they function at a different level of real preparation and just never letting anybody get away with any shit. I mean, so, and Mehdi Hasan is from that sort of school. So we could spend a lot of time talking about Matt Gaetz, which I'm sure we'll do over the next few weeks. But here is Mehdi Hasan in 1 minute summarizing Matt Gaetz. Everything you need to know about Matt Gaetz before this Pizzagate controversy in 60 seconds. Ladies and gentlemen, Mehdi Hasan gives you Matt Gaetz.
Start the clock. Matt Gaetz was elected to the Florida House in 2010, backed by his daddy Don Gaetz's deep pockets and Republican connections. Just 2 years after being arrested for driving under the influence, as a Florida legislator, he mocked women in tattoos for using welfare, called for recipients of welfare to be drug tested, suggested two black members of the state Senate did not know how to write or spell, and was one of only two Florida House members to vote against a bill criminalizing revenge porn. Elected to Congress in 2016, Gaetz invited an accused Holocaust denier to be his guest for the State of the Union, appeared on Alex Jones's InfoWars show, claimed Attorney General Jeff Sessions was a hostage of the deep state, called for the firing of Robert Mueller, defended Trump's description of Haiti as an asshole country, talked about cultural genocide, falsely accused George Soros of funding a migrant caravan 10 days before a white supremacist massacred 11 Jews at a synagogue, wore a gas mask to mock the threat from COVID, attended a maskless party for young Republicans in New York at the height of the pandemic, and was the only member of Congress to vote against a bill to combat human trafficking. Funny that. In February, during the second impeachment trial, Matt Gaetz said he would quit his job and leave his home to defend Donald Trump. The question is, will Donald Trump now do the same for him?
No.
Answer to that.
60 seconds. You know, I feel like just sort of like lying back and lighting up a cigarette now, but I don't smoke.
I will have one. I have like one cigarette a month, Charlie, and so I might have to use mine up on that this afternoon. That was really good. No, just minor correction to Media. I think he went to multiple maskless parties at the height of the pandemic, including the viral video where he's doing karaoke to Wagon Wheel. Did you see this? And has kind of a young woman scratching his back, and they're all maskless in a tiny hotel room. Anyway, he's an interesting character.
It is interesting and not a surprise it turns out that everybody hates Matt Gaetz, with the exception of Marjorie Taylor Greene and Jim Jordan. But everybody else on the Republican conference appears to be really enjoying this. Now, they're not calling for him to resign or anything like that, because I think they just figure that he's going to fall apart on his own. But you can tell this is the one thing that has brought together more than 400 members of Congress, and they're all sitting there with popcorn.
I'm not sure that's right, Charlie. I think there are at least some of them that he was showing naked pictures of women hula hooping to. So I think they consider themselves Gaetz's friends. He's kind of the type of person that would rub you the wrong way, no pun intended, for sure. And so I think he does have people who don't like him. But, nobody has spoken out. I don't know. I just – you see the misalignment between the parties. I do think this is important. Like, at this point, Andrew Cuomo – now, it took a while. So, maybe people will come around, though I'm not hopeful. But the entire Democratic delegation has called for Cuomo to resign at this point in New York. Whereas you get nothing from Gaetz. I don't know that they assume that he's going to, just fizzle out. I mean, remember, these were people that ended up supporting Roy Moore when it came around to it, after he was, in a phoebophilia. That was the big defense of Roy Moore at the Federalist, you'll remember. This wasn't pedophilia, it was a phoebophilia, 14 to 17. That's a different animal here. Let's make sure we're precise in our criticisms. And so I don't know. I mean, I think that there is right now no guardrails around the Republican caucus, and the people look around and they're like, they have no idea what the voters are going to find acceptable or unacceptable. They have no principles left. They have no standards left. And so they don't know where to draw any lines.
So what's Trump going to do? See, you can see what Gaetz's, mode is going to be when he was on Tucker Carlson's show. And he said, yeah, Tucker, remember when you and I had that double date? You met her. He's like, no, I don't. You can imagine he's on the phone with Donald. Don, remember when we were, hanging out, and Mar-a-Lago with those really gorgeous chicks that you introduced me to? And so is Donald Trump going to go, I don't know you, Matt. No, I don't remember that. Or what's he going to do?
I think Donald Trump is going to say F you, pound sand, to Matt Gaetz. Didn't Trump forget Matt Gaetz's name at a rally?
See, this is the thing about Trump is he despises the people who suck up to him the most.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and Gaetz does have this sort of personality. I mean, I think this is the one thing that you are right about in observing this. He's kind of like the everybody had this guy in high school who was sort of like the obnoxious bully, but maybe he was a rich kid, right? So you'd throw parties at his parents' houses, but everybody kind of hated him because he was sort of a dick. And then, as you get towards senior year and as you get towards graduation, people are like, wait a minute, I don't have to be nice to this guy. I don't have to be nice to this guy anymore. Like, Gaetz does have that, persona. Like, he seems like the kind of guy that doesn't probably have any friends from Pensacola High or wherever he went, or from FSU, that he's maintained, that he's tried to kind of upgrade and, revise and extend his friend group as he gets more famous and, as his hair gets bigger and he gets new teeth and all that.
The hair is something, yeah. So, okay, I want to revise and extend something I said before, that I was already okay. Sick of the term canceled, but yep. I want to reserve it for Matt Gaetz canceled. I won't be able to resist that. If that ever happens. So
I just don't think it will. I mean, he represents the panhandle, right? I mean, it's like, I think it's one of those things where unless he gets jailed, there is just no enforcement mechanism for the Republican Party to actually you know, hold anybody in line. Well, I mean, look, I was interested.
Felony indictments.
Yeah, Jonah was tweeted out the other day a clip from Bill Bennett's book, The Death of Outrage. Oh. I really love this one line. This is one of the pull-out kind of clips from The Death of Outrage that they put on the book jacket. The modern allergy to judgments and standards is deeply problematic. I love that sentence because it could sound like a modern day quote with the use of problematic. But you know, there are no judgments and standards left within the party. And so I don't know what is the enforcement mechanism for getting rid of them, for canceling them?
I don't know, felony prison,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, something like that. No, has Bill Bennett gone on Fox News to comment on Gates? I don't know.
Nobody has talked about it on Fox News. I haven't seen the latest, but there was like a 48-hour period after it broke where nobody's talked about it. I guess they've decided it's not news. You know, the other interesting thing about Gates to me is that he's a peer of mine, so I think he's an interesting case study, right? I mean, he's my age. He went to, you know, college, you know, FSU, and he went to law school at William & Mary, right? Like, he's not a, you know, a MAGA red hat wearing, you know, kind of working class populist person, right? Like, he grew up in the house from one of those Jim Carrey movies. Like, his dad's mm-hmm. really rich. He seems like the kind of guy who's faking it, right? I mean, you know, at the start, at least that was the impression that I had of him.
Yeah.
I'm reading this book right now. If you haven't read it, I really recommend it. It's called A Political Education. It was Harry McPherson, who was Lyndon Johnson's advisor.
Yeah.
And in this book, he's talking about one of the senators from South Carolina, I think Olin Johnson, who's watching Strom Thurmond rail about civil rights, and he looks at him and says, the segregationist senator looks at him and says, well, this guy actually believes this stuff, you know, and the story is that it's actually maybe the person that's voting with Strom who doesn't believe it that's the worst character. And I thought that was Matt for a while, but man, when you listen to that Mehdi Hasan rant, when you listen to him to talk about how the deep state is after him, I think that he may just have been, he might be high on his own supply here and have just gone totally down a really crazy path.
Doesn't Denver Riggleman, or who is it? Denver Riggleman, or I'm sorry, or is it Adam Kinzinger, who described guys as drinking their own bathwater? I'll give them both credit for
but
it.
It seems like Gates is doing that, right? Like, that it might have been a performative act for a while, but this, I mean, he is, he's lost the plot.
So you're the same age as Matt Gaetz.
Yeah. I mean, and I worked with his sister. He's an interesting character for me because I kind of know the type. As I said, I know I can picture him in high school.
Wait. You worked with his sister?
Yeah. I worked with Matt's sister, worked for Jeb.
It's like dropping that in. I mean,
yeah. Oh, sorry. No, I mean, I know. That's what I'm saying. I know. I don't know Matt. Like, we've never, I've talked to him, but like, I don't, you know, we've never.
No parties at his house.
We've never spent quality one-on-one time. We've never been to a Georgetown cocktail party together, but. I know his sister. I know his dad. His dad endorsed Jeb. I know the type. He's my age. And so
please clap.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Jeb. you know, is the one thing he was right about, broken clocks. But you know, I look at Louis Gohmert, right, or Lauren Boebert, or Marjorie Taylor Greene, or Tommy Tuberville, and I'm like, these people are lunatics. You know, okay, like some of it might be performative, but like they're lunatics. And I look at Matt, probably how you must look at Ron Johnson, right? Which is like, I think that this is an act, but like, well, maybe an act anymore.
Well, see, I think Matt Gaetz is one of these guys who goes, what do I have to say? What do I have to do to get laid? I mean, it's what I'm saying? It's like, if I became this person, would it be more likely? If I say these things, then I get to go to a TPUSA convention and all the college Republicans and the college high school kids. I don't know. So you're the same age as Matt Gaetz. I was shocked this morning. I was on Morning Joe, and I realized that I am the same age as Al Sharpton. And I got to say, that was one of those, like, what? what?
You imagine yourself a little more youthful than Al in your mind's eye, Charlie?
Well, okay, I'm sorry. You know, in my head, yeah, I'm thinking, really? So I looked him up, and he's like, he's a month older than me. So nobody cares about this. I know this.
You look pretty much, you look great. I mean, okay, very spry. So, that's an important month.
Spry. See, that's a spry. See, that's spry. And you actually, when that left your mouth, you thought, hey, here's a way of praising him. He'll like that. Because everybody aspires to be spry. Okay. So let's talk about why the boycott Tim name here.
Yeah.
You had a fantastic email over the weekend, Triad email, where you waded into the Vietnam of American political rhetoric, which is Georgia. And I am exactly where you are on that. I am wrestling with this. I find this to be a completely deplorable bill. I think that the legislature acted in bad faith. I think there's real danger that the politicization of the election process could lead to stealing an election in the future. On the other hand, it is time to take a deep breath and go, you know, some of this rhetoric is just way over the top. The whole Jim Crow 2.0. And Republicans and the right are latching onto the inaccuracy. So talk to me about your take on the Georgia bill, which is nuanced, which means you're getting killed by both sides.
Well, actually, I don't know that it's that nuanced. It's kind of strident in one way and very specific in another. But look, let me do the big long wind up here for everybody, because I think it's important. What is happening with the Republican Party in the wake of Donald Trump's loss in November is absolutely unconscionable in every imaginable sense. The concerted effort that's going around across many states to limit the vote is based on a lie that has caused the death of a police officer in the siege of our Capitol. It is racist. It's specifically targeting, black communities in urban centers throughout the country. It's an attempt to hold on to power while maintaining minority popular support. This is a party that's won one popular vote since this century. There will be people who will vote for the first time in 2024 who will have never seen the Republicans win a popular vote. They realize that. And so they're trying to hold on to power through minority rule rather than expand their support, rather than expand the message so that it can appeal to more people. All of that, from the big picture sense, is freaking grotesque. And I just don't know how anybody can listen or read The Bulwark and think that we just brook it in any form or fashion. It's just, it's horrific. And the Georgia bill is one cog in this broader effort. By the way, so is that stupid Donald Trump Easter tweet. So is the campaign that's going on, which I've written about, in Virginia and in Ohio, where all these candidates are pretending like, that the election had been stolen, and they're all putting out proposals about how to limit the vote, how under the auspices of voter integrity, and then leaking it to Fox News and Newsmax. I mean, this is a multifaceted effort. It's happening on the donor side. There's that great Jane Mayer report about how Koch and McConnell are working together. So this is completely unacceptable. It's a party that is not committed to democratic values, and it's why I'm not going to be able to support any Republicans. It's one of many reasons, but maybe the top of the list in the near future, or maybe for quite a while. So you can believe all that this is awful, and then also look at the Georgia bill itself and say, guys, this just isn't Jim Crow on steroids. It just isn't, right? I mean, it's part of this broader effort that is undemocratic, where the Republicans want to try to hold on power through minority with minority control, and where they want to suppress votes, particularly black and brown votes. It just, like, the substance of the bill, I mean, you still have 17 days of early vote. There's still plenty of opportunity to vote in Georgia. So that doesn't make it okay. It doesn't make it good. But when the president is saying it does things it doesn't, like, prevent people from voting after 5 o'clock so working people can't vote, that's just not true. He said it multiple times. When they're saying it's, you know, kind of worse than Jim Crow, which is just an absolute stain on our history, which prevented, you know, people to vote based on poll taxes and tests, and a lot of other methods, you sometimes lose credibility. And so some people say, well, that's a strategic point. You want to build up outrage so more people turn out and vote. Maybe that's true. Maybe this will turn off suburban voters, though. You know, maybe this will turn off, you know, voters that are pretty conservative, but that are grossed out by the Republicans and now look at the Democrats and say, I'm not making equivalency, but maybe some of these voters end up making equivalency in their head. That's not good. So, you know, there's just something to be said for, like, this what the Republicans are doing are bad enough in truth, right? You don't need to gild the lily on this. And so that's the frustrating part for me.
Yeah, if you stick to the actual facts, but, you know, you get a lot of whataboutism, which is, oh, come on, how dare you accuse Joe Biden of being wrong or saying the Democrats are over the top on the rhetoric after what we've endured with Donald Trump. Well, that's literally the whataboutism. And there's, you know, there's two problems with that. If we've spent 4 years objecting to the big lie, and, you know, the consequences of engaging in this kind of hyperbole and exaggeration is, number one, you undermine your own credibility, but also you have the effect of retrospectively making the lies of the past not so bad because everybody does it. So that's part of the problem. But, you know, and you mentioned this yesterday, there is that vibe, and this is where guys like us feel it kind of like a little bit of PTSD. Yeah. It comes down to but we fight the evil opposition. I mean, we've lived through this, but we fight. And of course, this is what we heard on the right for many, many years. Okay, maybe it's not true. Maybe it's over the top, but it's time for us to take the fight to those hypocrites who deserve no mercy whatsoever. And we get it fed back to us now.
Yeah. And again, I want to be abundantly clear. I do not see that this is an equivalence. I don't think the Democrats are anywhere near like nominating a Donald Trump like figure like that. That's not what I'm saying here. But there are problems short of, you know, nominating a like egomaniacal, bigoted, incompetent for the presidential nomination that a party can run into if you create a culture where you can't dissent. Right. Like we cannot have a culture where people cannot dissent and cannot point out mistakes and point out flaws. I'm sure there are, by the way, people on the left of Joe Biden that think that and say, you know, say that. And that's true for them, too. Right. I mean, people have blind spots. You know, I mean, this is part of governing, part of political coalition building. There's value to getting feedback. So in this specific case, like matter that much? I guess my question is, we don't know, right? Like, we don't know what the answer in Georgia is. I mean, Eric Erickson, say what you want about Eric. He's said a lot of things I disagree with, but he knows Georgia. He says he thinks this week that Brian Kemp assured his reelection. He kind of mended his problems with the right that happened from him not going along enough with the big lie. You know, meanwhile, Raphael Warnock might have gotten himself into trouble for his reelection. I don't know if that's true. We won't know until November 22nd. But why give them something? Like, when they have made so many screw-ups, when they've been so, you know, said so many lies and gaslit, and when their entire political program in Georgia is crumbling, why give them something? Like, there's just enough to work
there is enough. And again, you know, focusing on the, you know, the retaliation against Brad Raffensperger, the one truth teller, certainly a red flag. The fact that it gives the partisan legislature more control over elections. But, you know, I'm trying to think about how this got to where it is now. And I think, you know, number one, the fact that the legislature was acting in bad faith means that they, you know, were given no benefit of the doubt. But also, a lot of the worst stuff that was proposed and debated was stripped out in the end. So that's where you get the Nate Cohns, and you have Will Salatin from Slate, and you have Glenn Kessler, who is the fact checker for the Washington Post, going in and saying, you know, this actually expands the days and the hours available for early in-person voting. It does things like requires polls with long waiting lines to add staff or another precinct for the next election. It has an online option for ballot applications. It does require at least one Dropbox per county. And there's some bad things in there, depending on how you feel about it. But the voter ID requirement basically says substitutes the signature matching for putting your either your driver's license ID, your other ID number on. It's more efficient there. And I think you saw. Do you see Woke Joe Walsh's tweet about this?
No, I didn't.
It was pretty good. You know, the former Illinois congressman. So Chuck Schumer, like a lot of folks, who puts out a tweet saying, you know, racist voter suppression laws are now hurting Georgia's voters and its economy. Georgia Republicans should be ashamed. We would welcome Major League Baseball to come play the All-Star game in New York. And Joe Walsh tweets out, and he's factually correct about this. New York only allows 9 days of early voting. Georgia's law allows 17 days of early voting. New York does not allow so-called no-excuse absentee voting. Georgia does. It is also illegal in New York to serve food and water to people in line. So he says, Senator, it sounds like it's actually harder to vote in New York than Georgia. How come? And this is kind of an awkward thing because I saw you linked to this as well. You compare the early voting in other states and Georgia is not more restrictive. And as a spry older guy, I am old enough to remember when, in fact, elections were held on election day. And if anything, we have made it dramatically easier to vote. And I think we should make it even easier to vote. But that's where the Jim Crow 2.0 or some of the things that Joe Biden has said about this just are go too far. And they backfire.
And so just like three things really quick. Number one, I do think that Joe Walsh on the water, I haven't looked at this that closely, but I saw some back and forth on this. And I think that technically the New York water rules are a little bit, whatever, less stringent than what they put in Georgia. But that's not really relevant to this point, which is that there are a lot of blue states that have extremely restrictionist voting rules, including New York. And by the way, those should be changed. Like, here's the thing. I'm for automatic voter registration. Like, I don't understand why we can't do this. There are a lot of countries, the former president of Estonia is a Bulwark fan. And, you know, the system that they've got in countries like that is much more relevant for the future than this kind of patchwork system that we have in this country. So I think everybody should have automatic voter registration. They should be able to register day of, and we can have provisional ballots where if there are any questions and they need to, you know, be verified that this isn't a fake voter or that this isn't somebody committing fraud, then they can go into the provisional pile and we can check and investigate it in the week after the election, right? Like this, there are ways to do this that make it as easy as possible for everybody to vote, and I'm for that, and they should do that in a bunch of these states. But that's not the reality of where we are now. And so I just think that when it comes to Georgia, the biggest picture truth about what is happening in Georgia is that the only reason that they changed their election laws at all to make it more restrictive in certain areas is because the Republican legislature and the Republican governor, you know, wanted to continue to advance, you know, the big lie that said that our elections were rigged, that resulted in the insurrection, that resulted in the siege of the Capitol, that resulted in the death of the police officer, and they're doing so in an attempt to further restrict voting so they can keep power while being a minority party. That's fucking bad enough as it is, Charlie. Yeah. Like, it's horrible. And it's happening in every state, basically, that there's a Republican legislature. And there should be pitchforks. There should be outrage over the fact that Republicans are doing this everywhere. And so, I just don't get why we have to, now get down into exaggerating what is already an absolutely horrible, unconscionable position that is endemic within every Republican office holder, basically every Republican campaign.
So I wrote about this morning, sort of a related development here. You know, after Major League Baseball decided it was going to move the All-Star game, even though, by the way, Stacey Abrams and other Georgia Democrats said they didn't want them to do it, what's interesting to me is this new right-wing cancel culture where you have Donald Trump and of course everybody else from, you know, Matt Schlapp and Ronna McDonald and Hugh Hewitt all in that we have to boycott Major League Baseball. Delta Airlines, we have to boycott Coke because they came out against this. But it's beyond that. I mean, it's to me, you know, watching former constitutional conservatives like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee tweeting out about how, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to push legislation to strip Major League Baseball of its antitrust immunity. Now, I'm agnostic about whether they should have antitrust protect. Let's leave that aside. Clearly, what they're doing is they're saying because of this political action, because they are ideologically they've committed an ideological crime, we're going to use the power of our offices to use the power of the government to punish them. And your good friend, the culture war ambulance chaser, Chip Roy, also put out a tweet. I will co-sponsor this legislation and aggressively push it. Major League Baseball, happy to have ID required to pick up tickets, but not voting. American Airlines and Delta, you're on notice too. And he's retweeting one of his colleagues who said, in light of MLB's stance to undermine election integrity laws, I have instructed my staff to begin drafting legislation to remove Major League Baseball's federal antitrust exception. So they're not even pretending that they are not retaliating politically, using the power of the government to pass legislation to punish a private entity for its political actions. And this is not a one-off. You saw Republicans and the Georgia legislature come close to stripping a tax provision from Delta for because they're doing this. You know that your friend Josh Hawley, you know, when he's not fomenting insurrections, is threatening
all my friends.
I just Chip Roy,
Josh Hawley.
And what is it now? Mitch McConnell is taking aims at corporate U.S. He says, parts of the private sector keep dabbling and behaving like a woke parallel government. Corporations will invite serious consequences if they become a vehicle for the far left mobs to hijack our country from outside the constitutional order. Well, I don't know. Mr. Miller, that sounds like a threat to me. That's like, no, nice corporation you have there. It'd be a shame if anything bad would happen to it.
I guess I'd look back onto the folk wisdom of one Willard Mitt Romney that says that corporations are people, my friend, Mitch. This is so bizarre just from the perspective of somebody that's come up in the Republican culture where corporations were largely, not always, but like aligned with the political objectives of people on the right. It's pretty crazy when you think about it. Walmart. I mean, how many times has Walmart been aligned with Republicans on the Walton Foundation supporting school choice, opposing, minimum wage increases, big oil companies wanting to oppose climate legislation or work with Republicans on alternate climate legislation. It's just, time and again. The corporate America has not always, but largely been on the side of Republicans and engaged in politics, right? And during that time, like the idea that the government would then punish them for advocating for a political position that they think, aligns with their corporate values or would help their corporate bottom line, that would have been the kind of Bernie extreme left response to
Elizabeth
corporate
Warren
action, right? And it wasn't even mainstream. It wasn't even mainstream Democrats that would have done that, right? Like this would have been the provenance of like the Bernie Sanders far left. It's like, we have to punish Walmart because they are, engaging in school choice and we need to get big corporations out of our, out of our life. And now that's the Mitch McConnell position, right? The corporations need to be punished.
Well, and also the way they're doing it. But, part of this is this new, working class party, anti-corporate, position. But if you're a working class party and you don't actually want to do anything for the working class, I mean, they're not in favor of the minimum wage, right? They're not really in favor of, you know, more, you know, family leaves or childcare or any of those things. So what does the working class party do? Well, it turns everything into culture war. So the culture war and the anti-corporate war become the same thing. The culture war and class war become their thing. Marco Rubio's statement on this union vote down in Alabama was, I thought, fascinating. So, I mean, it's a very interesting story how they're trying to organize these workers at the Amazon plant in Bessemer, Alabama. And here's what the working class champion Marco Rubio said. Here's my standard, he writes. When the conflict is between working Americans and a company whose leadership has decided to wage culture war against working class values, the choice is easy. I support the workers. So he's for the union if they're against a company that is on the wrong side of the culture war. It's all culture war for these guys.
It wasn't the fact that Amazon workers were peeing in bottles on the warehouse floor. That wasn't what got Marco to you know, want to defend the workers as the representative of the working class party. It was the fact that the execs took the wrong position on voting rights legislation. And this is the same. You mentioned the Georgia legislature wanting to take the tax break away. I mean, this is economic policy has been completely subsumed by culture war and owning the libs, and it's a really a shocking change that happened seemingly overnight and now has, you know, a unanimity in support among the Republican Party. Like, you don't hear anybody saying, wait a minute, guys, like, I don't know if we should be like basing our taxation and unionization and, you know, antitrust positions on like this, an ephemeral position that one CEO takes on, you know, a voting rights issue. Like, more or less, I don't think that we should do it just because the CEOs want to make sure people have voting rights. Right. I mean, that's what this is at a fundamental level. I mean, maybe these CEOs don't have all the specifics right or whatever about a legislation. It's not their job. But at a fundamental level, what they're trying to do is signal and say, we want to make sure that voting rights are protected, which makes sense that corporate America would want to make sure voting rights were protected after the last president just attempted a coup. Right. So, they're just trying to put out this basic kind of sense. And Republicans are like, no, you need to be punished for that now. You need to have your tax breaks taken away from that. This is not a economically conservative party in any meaningful sense.
Well, anymore. And also it's not a party that seems to really understand the First Amendment at all. I mean, there was once sort of an understanding that you did not use government, you know, force to retaliate against someone for criticizing a politician or for criticizing a government action. So I'm getting a lot of comments and emails and social media posts from people who I think misunderstand something or haven't caught up on something. That, you know, the question, well, are Republicans biting the hand that feeds them because, you know, they are financed by corporate America, you know, these big checks? And the answer to that is this new stance is also a reflection of the way in which you have the center of fundraising, particularly on the right, shifting to those small dollar donors, you know, the Rubification of fundraising. And so they no longer are relying on the $100,000 check from AT&T when they can get, folks from, you know, from Wisconsin and Oregon and Arkansas to write them checks. Speaking of which, the story, I'm sorry to switch gears here, the story over the weekend in the New York Times about the Trump campaign and the incredible scam aimed at their own supporters, the ripoff, that what they did was that if people went online and said, yes, I want to support Donald Trump. And so I'm going to give him, I live in a nursing home and I have my income is $1,000 a month, but I'm going to give Donald Trump $500. And what they did was they took that money, and because they had an obscure box check that nobody could see, it became a recurring payment. So this person, you know, a couple of weeks later says, I've given them $8,000 or $9,000. They sucked it out. There are some estimates that as much as 3% of all of the credit card fraud complaints were aimed at the Trump campaign because they went out to rip off their own supporters. And the stories are just stunning. It's just, I feel like maybe we're repeating ourselves because, you know, Tim, that, you know, this whole thing was a scam. But what a cynical scam that the Trump campaign and the RNC were involved in here.
Yeah, and it's in line with what Bannon was doing with his scam about the fake wall. I mean, it's honestly sad. I mean, like what they're doing, and they're fleecing. Yeah, they're fleecing their own supporters, and people don't realize that this money's coming out of their checking account every month. And it's like for what end, right? I mean, to kind of fund these consultant salaries, to fund these insane, you know, the insane amount that that is required to run these campaigns. And it's because they've bought into this whole Flight 93 mindset, right? I mean, and so the other danger of moving. It's not really a danger anymore because it's happened, but of moving fundraising from, you know, these sort of institutional type of fundraising, which had its own, you know, corruption and flaws. But the change when you move that to now this kind of populist style of fundraising is that they got to keep people angry. Right, you're not going to give your $5 if the email from the Trump campaign is like, well, you know, Joe Biden made some good points today, but like, you know, he overstepped a little bit on this one area, and I wish you'd help. Right, like that's not. They have to continue to keep up the heat and to turn, you know, the volume to 11 on the fact that they're stealing the country from you. All the types of things that led people to storm the Capitol with Donald Trump flags and spear police officers. Right, like that's what they have to do to keep the money coming in. In addition to kind of tricking a lot of their, you know, older and let's just be honest, like older and less educated supporters who are not as familiar with kind of with how to use these sorts of online platforms. They might not understand all the little boxes you got to uncheck, you know, to prevent this thing from being a recurring donation. You saw that to the tune of like 9 figures, people that tried to claw some of their money back. So I mean, what is happening is really, really gross. It's part of this broader scam, but it is now what they're fully bought in on. When you look, when you see this anti-corporate campaign, that means they're fully bought in on this kind of scam, email and mail fundraising.
You know, what is startling reading that story is to realize the extent to which they have convinced people to give large amounts of money. I think shorthand we talk about, you know, people giving $5, but some of these stories that are in this piece that I would think a normal person would be embarrassed at the lower level contribute. Let me explain what I'm getting at here. So let me read you 2 paragraphs. This tactic that they used of making these recurring payments ensnared scores of unsuspecting Trump loyalists, retirees, military veterans, nurses, even experienced political operatives. Soon banks and credit cards were inundated with fraud complaints from the president's own supporters about donations they had not intended to make, sometimes for thousands of dollars. Listen to this story. Bandits, said Victor Amelino, a 78-year-old Californian who made a $990 online donation to Trump in early September via WinRed. Okay, so $990 for the 78-year-old retiree. It's a lot of money. But what they did was they made it recur 7 more times, adding up to almost $8,000. I'm retired, he said. I can't afford to pay all that damn money. So just at the lowest level, they're fleecing these retirees. They're scaring them. They're getting them worked up to give more money than they can possibly afford to the campaign. But of course, that's an individual choice they make. And then they sit around and go, how can we turn this into a money bomb? How can we get even more from them? And what's clear from the story is this was an intentional plan. They knew what they were doing. So here's my question, Tim, because you know how campaigns work. How did they think they were going to get away with this?
I think that you just keep pushing the envelope in online fundraising strategies, right? I mean, it's like, how did you get away with everything? You know, I think that there is you know, this idea of creating a recurring contribution is not something that the Trump campaign made up, right? And so there's always this kind of gray area, right? Which is, so do I make somebody proactively check a box, right? Or do I have the box already checked for them? Like, do I give them a warning? Is it in bold? Do I send them an email every time, the day before we're going to take out the next recurring contribution to let them know, to make sure that this is intentional, right? And so, you know, it's just like anything else, like any other types of donations. I mean, I have a recurring donation to some charities that I support, right? And some of the charities are much more upfront about it, right? And some of them are much scammier, you know? And so, and so I think they just dialed up the scammy side of this as much as possible and, you know, played a little more cloak and dagger and made it confusing. And I also think, like, we just have to, you know, this is not me criticizing the people that are donating it. We just have to be honest. The people that they're dealing with that are sending in these donations are just not as savvy internet consumers, right? I mean, just look at the generic, you know, Elizabeth Warren donor. Like, imagine that person in your head. Like, they're a person that uses online finance all the time, right? Like, and they are used to, you know, all the you know, different vicissitudes of how you you know, ask for money, right? That is not the case for all of the Donald Trump supporters who are, you know, who are less savvy about this sort of stuff, or more, you know, more rural, uneducated types of voters. And so they're taking advantage of them, and older, right? You know, older people as well. So it's just they're making it confusing and purposefully, and they're taking advantage of them, and they think that they can get away with it because, you know, at the end of the day, I think that they presume that, you know, they're sort of within on the outer edges of a gray area, and that their own people aren't going to complain about them, and they pushed it too far.
Okay, so in the few minutes we have left, you've been enjoying March Madness along with everybody else, even though it's now April, fantastic Final Four. You have strong feelings on this whole question that's going to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court shortly about whether or not college athletes should be paid. My sense is the court may be poised to say that it's ridiculous to pay the coaches millions of dollars and have the schools make billions of dollars and the athletes themselves make nothing. What do you think?
Well, right before I get into that, can we just chuckle really quick about how this might be the only sport left for Republicans?
I do wonder if the liberals
got to be like, how did we get football and baseball and the NBA and the culture
and NASCAR.
Wars
and NASCAR?
NASCAR. Like, how did we win all of these things in the culture wars? Like, you know, I do just sort of sometimes it makes me it's dark in a macabre way. It makes me laugh to think about the fact that the Patriot Party is anti-baseball, anti-NASCAR, anti-football, anti-Hollywood, anti-Big Tech, anti-Coca-Cola. It's like, what part of the country do you like still? I don't quite know sometimes. But as far as the college pay is concerned, it's been a long time hobby horse of mine. It is a complete abuse of the kids. What is happening is a total farce. You watch the March Madness, which has been great, by the way. My brother went to Gonzaga, and so I'm pulling for the Zags tonight, and just they've had such a magical run. That 3-point shot was, I can still enjoy this while understanding that the kids are being taken advantage of. It was just such a beautiful game on Saturday night. But a lot of these kids come from poor backgrounds, and this is the height of their earning potential. And I just always, as somebody who comes from like a free market background and a pro freedom background, I never understood how conservatives a lot of times were the ones who wanted to be like, we need to keep it like the old ways. And, you know, they're getting a college education out of this. What more do you want? And it's like, well, I want them to be able to get paid for the services that they're offering you, for all the entertainment that they're bringing to you. And, you know, I think about, I'm an LSU fan. I think about like the 10th best player on the LSU defense, right? Like, that is not on this year's national championship team. Like, that's not somebody that's going to make a lot of money in the NFL, right? Like, the quarterback will be fine, but the 10th best player on the defense is not going to make a lot of money in the NFL. This is when they can make money. Like, he should be able to do ads for the local car dealership, and he should be getting paid by LSU, which is making tens of millions of dollars, and the coach is getting paid. You know, we just fired a coach that we paid like $5 million and had to buy him out because he had a bad year. like that money just went down the drain. And so why can't this kid, when he is at the height of his earning potential, when he's a local celebrity somewhere, make money? And it's all just a big scam that the, because the NCAA has been perpetrating this lie of, you know, that they're so-called student athlete amateurs, right? And it's just a faux amateurism that has allowed them to retain money. And, you know, I can go deep on email with you. They're all, if somebody wants to push back with me on this, I love fighting about it. There are all these other random arguments. None of them hold water to the fact that, like, these kids deserve to be able to make, you know, whatever they can, you know, just like anybody else in any other market-based system. And, you know, you watch the Final Four and there's a commercial every 4 minutes and everything's sponsored. And it's just, it's a total farce. There's an official ladder, an official net. This whole thing is a joke. So I was encouraged to see Brett Kavanaugh, you know, make these kind of free market arguments that you would expect to hear from conservatives, but for some reason end up oftentimes getting pushed down in favor of the traditional, you know, traditionalist arguments. And so I'm hopeful that they go the right way. And I was happy to see that that Kavanaugh made some of these same points.
Is there any analogy? Is there any other institution where a billion-dollar industry or institution based on the efforts and labor of unpaid individuals? I'm trying to think of anything else. I'm sure I could, probably could, but I can't.
I mean, I'm sure nothing like underpaid, scale. Right? I no, mean, you know, I'm sure that like paid, union yeah. advocates would say mm-hmm. that, like, sure, yeah. there's right, like Walmart, Amazon. Yeah. We can go back to Amazon workers, right? Like, but the are people aren't making what maybe they should be able to bargain for and be worth. But these guys aren't even allowed to bargain, right? Like, these guys aren't getting anything. They're being, and it's literally Soviet. It was a good edit in my article from our editor, Adam Kuiper, who's like, nothing says the free market like giving people room and board. You know, I mean, it's literally an old Soviet mindset. So I can't think of an analogy, and especially something that is so important to our, you know, to the American culture, and that so much money is going through and that people love. I just, this idea that was being pushed by the NCAA that people will stop watching and they won't like it as much.
There's just no like, really? No, really? There's no evidence for that whatsoever. Yeah. That people wouldn't have not watched that game on Saturday night because they were getting paid. No, I just don't think so. I don't think so. Anyway, with the good news, thanks for joining me on the day after Easter. The good news, of course, is that Jesus is uncanceled. And remain so. Tim Miller, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Charlie. Go Zags.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I was going to ask you whether, you know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm going to actually watch that HBO QAnon special. I don't know whether you've seen that.
I haven't watched it. I want to. I can't. I'll be watching it tonight. I'll be watching the Zags, but maybe we can talk about it next week.
Yeah. You know, see, now I have to make a decision about that because we have a podcast about QAnon tomorrow. So I definitely have that on my list. In any case, thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.